going.
Sure do.
Today on Foraging Ahead, we have an interview with Ben Shute from Hardy Roots Farms, and he is a remarkable young man, a farmer, very well educated, and he's going to be talking to me about all sorts of issues regarding community-supported agriculture, soil, land use, land trusts. His baby is going to make a little appearance on the show as well. First, we generally do a segment called
Recalls.
Recalls. Just a few this morning for the month of June and the end of May. So here we go. Liv, you wanna read some of the recalls?
Sure.
And I'll cue up the recall music.
All right. Well, folks, these are things that are recalled. You should not eat them. If you have bought them and they're in your house, you should return them. We have a recall for Liquid Gold Carrot Juice by Healthy Choice Island Blends, Inc. And that's being recalled because it has a potential to be contaminated with Clostridium botulinum, which I believe is botulism.
That is true.
We've got Euphoria Fancy Food, Inc., recalling dried bream. This fish is uneviscerated and may pose a Clostridium botulinum hazard. Yikes. Hannaford is recalling mini frosted cookies. Reason, undeclared eggs. So if undeclared eggs make you nervous, watch
avoid,
out for those
avoid
cookies.
Avoid those cookies, yes.
Truitt Brothers recalling navy beans for undeclared soy. Now, Kevin, why would there be soybeans in navy beans?
That's a question I often wakes me up in the evening at
my
night.
Golly,
why soy in
navy beans
and everything? With soy's in everything.
It's a head scratcher.
Yeah.
You know. All right. We got a few more. We've got Ben and Jerry's ice cream. Fudge covered wafer pieces have been manufactured on shared equipment that process peanuts and tree nuts. So
peanuts and tree nuts.
If you have a bad peanut allergy and you've got some Ben and Jerry's ice cream with fudge covered wafer pieces, I don't know which flavor that is. It doesn't say, but watch out.
Yeah, that's useful. People do have peanut allergies, and you want to avoid them.
And Ben and Jerry's is great.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah. So cut even them some slack if you have a peanut allergy.
I got my issues
forewarned
with them, but ice cream in the summer is a good thing. Would you like to read the rest?
Sure.
Three down.
All right. Reggiano HEB Food Club More. Their boxed pasta mix products, they may contain small metal fragments.
Oh.
Yeah. And that's not a dietary supplement. These are small metal fragments. This is what happens when you have cheap food that is manufactured on an industrial scale.
Don't buy food from strangers.
Don't. That's pretty good policy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or get to know your grocer.
Yeah.
And there's another recall. Welles dietary supplements. Salmonella, which is not a dietary supplement, but a bacteria that's not good for you. And then Chef on the Run, Mia Fratello, their garden salad, deluxe salad, and romaine lettuce have listeria. Yeah, so Chef on the Run, maybe more Chef got the runs.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, especially, you know, why would you need to buy a bag of salad from Chef on the Runs when there's all this delicious local lettuce to be had?
Especially this time of year.
My God, it's good.
Yeah, we're gonna be talking with somebody who grows lettuce.
And how.
Yeah, and a CSA, Ben Shute. I didn't get around, actually, to sort of teasing him about his name and the fact that he's a farmer.
Well, it's not actually spelled the same way as the shoot in the, like, a pea shoot. It's with a U.
Yeah, but still, on the radio, people can't see that.
I know.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Well, it's not nearly as funny as if his last name was Ben Heirloom Tomato. then that would have been just too easy. So,
wow.
Yeah, yeah. I think there must be a farmer with that name, ultimately. So we're going to go, a little introduction. He's got a little bio and just a far-ranging and fascinating conversation, but just an intelligent, laconic at times, farmer. And then Liv, you brought in some music too.
Yeah.
So we'll be listening to some music.
Some farm and foraging related music.
Farm and foraging related music. Awesome. So here we go. Here's Ben Shute from Hardy Roots Farms. Talk a little bit about Hardy Roots, how you got started, why you're, you know, young fella decided farming is where I want to be, what I want to do. I can totally support myself on a farm.
Well, I didn't grow up on a farm, and so I got started farming just working for some other people who actually were farming using CSA. So
where did you grow up?
I grew up in New York City.
Really?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Manhattan, Brooklyn?
In Manhattan. And I was born in D.C., grew up mostly in Manhattan, and the only real experience I had with farming or gardening was I had grandparents in Ohio and grandparents in Connecticut, and, you know, would visit them, but never really knew anything about farming until I left home and went to college in Western Massachusetts in Amherst, where there was a whole lot of small farms in that community, and started to see what was going on there and realized how little I knew about it, not having grown up in a farming community, and was just really curious about it and figured a good way to learn a little bit about it, not thinking it was any kind of career path for me.
What did you study in college?
It was liberal arts. I was an anthropology major.
So farming seemed like a natural extension of that.
I was interested in food for sure, no matter what. But I think, you know, it was probably because I knew absolutely nothing about it and had no background in it that it was kind of piqued my interest at first and wanted to try and learn something about it. And I figured, all right, I'll work on a farm and I'll learn something about it, and then I'll go and pursue whatever other career I'm going to pursue. And little did I know that I would become completely absorbed and fascinated by how enormously much there was to learn about in the farming realm. Probably one of the things that surprised me about farming as I got to doing it was, especially with CSA farms, with diversified farms, with organic farms, is how, although no matter what farming you're doing, you're spending most of your time doing a lot of physical work. When you're running a sustainable farm, a diverse farm, it's never dull. It's always, you're acting as the steward of this complex ecosystem that's kind of, you know, you're responsible for, you know, creating this relationship between nature and people, and trying to produce value from soil, sun, and water. And there are just endless intellectual challenges in that process. And like, it's just, you know, it's never dull. You know, even if you're sitting there hoeing a bed of carrots all day, when you're doing this kind of farming, there's so many observations that you can be making, or other things you can be thinking about with your systems and things.
So you don't find that the physical labor sort of exhausts you to the point where you can't engage the brain to make it profitable? I mean, that's... I think serfs or indentured uh-huh. servants would free you up for more sort of intellectual musings.
Uh-huh. Well,
Or do you use... Do you have serfs? Do you have landed sort of peasantry?
When we started, so Hardy Roots is in its ninth season now, mm-hmm. and when we started, we did everything pretty much by hand, and everything with like two of us. And these days, there's 10 of us who work at Hardy Roots.
Oh. Full time?
Well, not full time, you know, during, like right now, and it's, you know, June, and so it's the peak time of year where we're still planting a lot, mm-hmm. we're weeding a lot. We're harvesting now a lot, and so everything's going full on. So there's 10 of us right now. Like last month, there were 7 of us, and then when the summer's starting to wind down, there'll be fewer. And then there's like three or four of us year round. So first of all, yeah, like I used to be doing physical work all day, no matter what, on the farm because it was me or no one. Now that there's more of us, sometimes I find myself doing more logistics than I would like.
Mm-hmm. And what are the logistics that you have to sort of
payroll and sourcing supplies and driving trucks to the city full of vegetables and calling prospective CSA members back on the phone and stuff like that. So there, you know, there's a million jobs on a farm, and I'm lucky to work with some great folks who do a lot of great work, both physical work in the fields and managing farm systems. And I am able to delegate some management responsibilities to some of the folks who've been working with me for a few years with that. So that's helps that system be able to run efficiently in a way that when we were doing everything with just two of us, it was quite overwhelming.
I imagine, yeah.
And now that there's more of us, it allows us to kind of spread around responsibilities, do a better job. We have more tractors and stuff now that allow us to actually, you know, it's still a
did
lot
Did you not
of,
have tractors before?
At the very beginning, we didn't have a tractor.
Uh-huh.
And we got neighbors to help us out when we needed some really heavy, you know, plowing done and stuff like that. Chuck Mead helped us plow our first field, and the Bulkley family, who we rented our first piece of land from, helped us out with some of their old tractors. Mm-hmm. But we were like hilling potatoes by hand with shovels that first couple
old
of
style,
years.
Old style,
wow. Yeah, that was, it's no fun. It's not.
Hilling, no. No, that's why serfs were sort of invented.
Yeah. but now, you know, now that we have some of the equipment to make, you know, there's still a lot of physical work to do no matter what, especially on any vegetable farm. Almost everything that you're harvesting is going to be by hand,
mm-hmm.
With a few exceptions on any diversified vegetable farm. But, you know, there's a lot of tasks that were like literally breaking my back the first few seasons, uh-huh. that now we have the equipment and the infrastructure to do a little bit more easily.
So I'm curious, actually, at what point? So you're a graduate of Amherst,
mm-hmm.
right? And you're wanted to learn about farming, so you go on a farm. Shows you the value of a liberal arts education because you pretty much think you can do anything,
right?
And you can if you learn how to think about things. At what point? Was there an aha moment? Did you have an epiphany? Like, wow, this is something I could spend, I could just wreck my body on for the rest of my life.
I think it was just at a certain point I got so far into it that it seemed like there was no turning back.
How so?
Just, you know, at the point where I was running my own farm and.
Oh, it was when you started Hardy Roots.
Yeah, uh-huh. I think when I first started. Doing Hardy Roots, I think I didn't even know if this was going to be my permanent thing. It seemed like, well, you know, I'll learn something farming on my own. You know,
uh-huh.
I actually didn't really think it was even going to be possible because I didn't have, you know, I'd worked for other farmers, but I didn't have any clear idea of how I would be able to farm for myself. I didn't have land that I inherited and didn't know how I would get land and didn't have equipment and, you know, so. I kind of never thought of it as a real possibility when I was working for other farmers. And then the way I ended up in the Hudson Valley was I got to know a friend of mine, Brianna Davis, who was a Bard graduate, who was in a similar situation to me. And
unemployed?
Well, no. She was employed on a farm, someone else's farm,
and
was interested in farming on her own,
cool.
but didn't have land and didn't come from a farming family. But she was here in the Hudson Valley and had a bunch of connections and made a connection with the Bulkley family in Red Hook and Tivoli. And so she's the one who identified that land that Hardy Roots got started on. And so Brianna really is the one who got Hardy Roots going thanks to that land connection. And she's the one who really did all the work the first year. And I was just helping out. And Brianna since... After a couple of years, she moved across the river to pursue other projects, and I kept Hardy Roots going. But, you know, when I first started farming here in Red Hook, I don't think I knew that I was going to stick with it forever. Mm-hmm. I think I thought, all right, well, here's an opportunity to actually rent some land and try this on my own, and that'll be exciting. And if it works, it'll be great. And if it fails, then I will learn something. Uh-huh. It worked, thanks in a large part to the CSA model.
And how does the CSA model is? You talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. So we've always, you know, when I farmed for other people, I was working on these community supported agriculture farms, and that was just, I was. Part of the reason I was drawn to farming was I really liked that model as a kind of sustainable relationship between farmers and consumers, and sharing the risk and the rewards of harvest, and this kind of cooperation that was happening in that relationship. And so I both like just liked that idea and the philosophy behind it and ethics behind it.
Could you just talk briefly about how the model
works?
Because of my four listeners, I think maybe one or two of them might not know how that works.
So CSA is a relationship between a farmer and a eater in which they share the risks and rewards of the farming process. So in our case at Hardy Roots, we have members who subscribe to our farm for the season. Our growing season runs June through October, sometimes into November. And our members sign up in the spring or sometimes partway into the season. We actually are still accepting some members now. And they pay a fee that comes out to about, it's like $500 or $600 a year. Mm-hmm. And in return, they get to partake in all the different 50 plus types of vegetables that we grow and harvest on the farm.
50?
Probably, yeah, more than that. I lose count, but but we grow pretty
much... It's not just kale.
No, we pretty much grow everything, every vegetable you can grow in the Northeast, we try and grow. There's a couple exceptions of ones that I don't like, but it's almost all of them. So even rutabagas now. For a while, I didn't like to grow rutabagas because I didn't like them, but now I have grown to like them, and so I'm excited about growing them.
Oh, really? But, so you come in with some culinary prejudices about what...
One or two.
No, I'm the same way. It's like if I don't like it, nobody on the planet would possibly like it. Yeah, but what?
But we're good about predicting what people like and don't like. So, you know, we grow a lot more tomatoes and lettuce and arugula and potatoes than we do kohlrabi and rutabagas. You know, we tilt the balance towards the favorites. Lots of carrots, lots of greens.
So does getting that money up front for the season help as opposed to just selling directly to the public?
Yeah, it helps enormously. Especially when we were first getting started, we didn't have a pile of money to be financing a startup operation, and you're not going to get a loan to start a small
farm.
Well,
I mean, that seems to be the sort of the classic sort of farm model is that you borrow a ton of money from the bank, you buy your seed, you plant, and then, you know, hopefully you sell your crop or whatever at the end of the year, and then you pay the bank back. And it's just this constant chase. I mean, this is my most basic of understanding. So,
yeah, and if you're doing a big commodity, you're probably also buying insurance, and that'll help.
But then you're getting government subsidies.
Yep. Yeah. So now, even if we wanted to try and follow more of that model, doing vegetables, it just doesn't work that way. There's not really, if you're growing a couple of crops, you can get that insurance. But if you're growing a diverse array of crops, it's not. Yeah, I think there's kind of two ways that people are trying to make it more viable for small and diverse farms to make it and to start up anew. And there's definitely a big push on trying to make policies help that happen. And so I'm a co-founder of, and my wife Lindsay is the executive director of this National Young Farmers Coalition organization. So actually I spend a lot of effort, and Lindsay spends all of her effort on working on that side of things, trying to affect better policy for small farmers, sustainable young farmers. And so there are ways to go about it from that strategy. But then I think like CSA is a key example of a model where you're just, the community is coming together to make it happen.
Mm-hmm. And people come
policy.
And they pick, they, how do they get, how do you get the produce to them? Or do they
so
pick it up at the farm?
When we started in 2004, we just had 30 families that mm-hmm. belonged to our CSA. And every week they just came to the farm in Red Hook, and we'd pick their produce in the morning and they'd pick it up in the afternoon. And that first year we didn't have a cooler or anything, so we just kept it in this dairy barn that was nice and cool, and it was as simple as that. Just came, picked it up. We picked whatever was ready that morning, and mm-hmm. our 30 members came and picked it up in the afternoon, and the money that they paid us that spring allowed us to buy the seeds and the hand tools and the irrigation fittings to grow that food.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked great, although that season was particularly backbreaking because we were doing everything by hand. So we had a plan for doing more acreage and more shares. And so now we've grown quite a lot, and we manage like 20 acres of vegetables. And we have about almost 600 families that belong to our CSA.
Wow.
And that's not just those who come to the farm. We still have about 75 families that come to the farm, which is now on Pitcher Lane in Red Hook. And the rest, we have a site over in Woodstock and one in Kingston that we, on Wednesday evenings, bring veggies over there. And at the Maritime Museum down on the Rond out in Kingston, people congregate, and we have a little table there, and we distribute the members' veggies. And in Woodstock on Glasgow Turnpike at the Woodstock Jewish Congregation building, we do a distribution on Wednesdays. And then twice a week, we now take a truck down to the city
uh-huh.
and do CSA sites with 5 different neighborhoods, 3 in Brooklyn and 1 in the Bronx and 1 in way up in northern Manhattan. And then we've also done a really great program the last 3 years in partnership with a couple nonprofits in the city. So we actually now grow, in addition to our CSA shares for families who pay their membership fees and get their veggies every week, we do 1,200 pounds of produce a week that we're growing specifically for a group of 5 food pantries in Flatbush in Brooklyn.
And what do they need?
They need fresh produce that's not, you know, left over from the grocery store, that's cycled into the food system after it's wilted and rotten, you know? And we actually are doing this project. It's with the United Way of New York City and Just Food, which is a nonprofit in the city, and the New York State Department of Health funds it.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually get paid to grow this fresh produce for these food pantries. So it's not just like seconds that didn't sell or something like that. This is stuff that we're growing specifically for these.
Yeah, but you could totally fob off inferior vegetables on them.
I think they'd probably catch on.
All right. what has been the most surprising thing that you've learned?
I think one thing that that I definitely didn't appreciate.
That was Ben Shute. First part of the interview, and now Liv, you've got a little music coming up, is that right?
I got a little music we could listen to.
All right.
If my computer didn't just shut off.
Did your computer shut off?
It may have.
Oh, that's...
No, it didn't. Okay.
Well, I've got a couple other sections.
I got it.
You got it?
It's
ready to roll? All right.
I'm just gonna sort of get back on the internet, but, yeah, I don't know. That was an interesting interview.
Oh, thank you. I was struck when I went away that I'm so happy he is, in fact, not selling credit default swaps or engage in some other sort of business, because he really speaks like a businessman. He understands the systems. He talks about systems.
Yeah.
He talks about some pretty, for me, complex, you know, economic models, and you know, in addition to the backbreaking work on the farm,
there's a lot to it, and I think that interview really communicated that. Hardy Roots. I remember Hardy Roots starting up when I was a Bard student, and actually my band played the benefit show to get the when Brianna started the farm through a big party in this barn in Tivoli.
Really?
Yeah. And you know that barn right on Broadway, the little house barn?
Oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah, there was a big old party there and all these people came and a potluck and a bunch of bands played and then they kicked off. Yep. And we're still here.
They almost 10 years later. Yeah. And they finally got some land in Claremont, yeah, in Columbia County. And
I had a Hardy Roots CSA in Brooklyn also.
Oh really?
Yeah, for 2 years.
Yeah. And it's a real going concern, and it's like I said, it's nice that such brilliant, hardworking young people have a soul and an interest in sustainable, viable agriculture and community.
Some of us do.
Yeah, no, it's good. It's so hard to be a curmudgeon when I meet young, yeah, and you and
all
the
kinds
people
of
involved
intelligent,
here,
young, hardworking people in this region.
I know. It gives me hope occasionally.
Good.
So what have we got going on now on your magic box?
I have a song. I have a few songs I'd like to share, but this is a song by a friend of mine, John Hu.
John who?
John Houx, and it's called Apple on a Table Green.
All right, Apple on a Table Green. Let's hear that.
Should be on. Wait, we're having an issue.
Are we having an issue?
Yeah, put the it's the quarter inch one iPod, and you have to. Sorry, folks.
Apple on a table, green apple, green apple, apple on a table, green. Picked by hand, fed to man, grown in a machine. Born of a branch in a foreign land centuries ago. Stick it in the ground the whole world round, pray that it should grow. Crossbreed an apple seed with an alligator gene. Oh, apple on a table, green, apple, apple on a table, green. Fly upon an apple, shoe, fly upon an apple, shoe. I'd rather eat a poison apple than an apple touched by you. You're owl and trout and mouse and frog and ladybug and bet you better not stay here. For today the poison spray has business to do. Fly upon an apple, shoot, fly, gonna do away with you. Dollar in a pocket, green, dollar, dollar in a pocket, green. Made and paid by poison spray, better get your dollar clean. Your boy and girl around the world, don't you save that seed. You've always sown, now we all will sell you what you need. You say you're very poor with a family to feed. Well, dollar in a pocket, green, dollar, dollars don't come clean. There's a ringing in a steeple, bell tower, ringing in a steeple bell. Mother's son, the youngest one, they couldn't get him well. And those diseased say, doctor, please, can't you help us mend? Well, my friend, that all depends how much you have to spend. If you knew a thing or two of Mother Nature's laws, first and most important is all things have a cause. And bugs don't come from a lack of drugs, just look at how you live. Life don't come from what you take, but from what you have to give. Apple on a table, green apple, apple on a table, green. Made and invade by poison spray. Better get your dollar clean.
Wow, very, very, very appropriate.
Yeah, I'm a really big fan of that song. I've played it a lot of times, and I got to share the recording with you all, so I hope, you know.
You played it where?
I've performed it.
Oh, yeah.
All over the place.
I love the topicality of the content and the form, that old sort of.
Yeah, it's like a protest song.
It's a kind of an old protest song.
Yeah.
Yeah, really enjoy the continuity there.
Cool.
Yeah, it's exciting. So what else you got?
This is a song by Michael Hurley called Parsnip Snips.
And Parsnip Snips?
I know that Hardy Roots Farm grows delicious parsnips, which I've enjoyed for many years. So this is going out to you guys.
All right. That was sweet. That had just parsnip all over it.
Yeah. A mellow place. The parsnip place.
Parsnip place. I like parsnips and carrots. That's a nice, and mashed all together.
Yeah, it's a good one to sort of mix in with other vegetables that you want to disguise together as this new thing.
Mm. It is new. And
it's new and delightful.
I'll give you my secret to parsnips.
What is it?
It's a little Chinese five spice.
What?
I know, it sounds crazy, but it's really, really good. Just a little bit of Chinese five spice.
Wow.
And it completely transformed it into not just a side dish, but something you want to eat 24 hours a day.
What are the five spices?
It's
a secret.
It's a secret, yeah.
Wow.
I think star anise, clove, salmonella, I don't know.
Oh, gosh.
No, I think it's not. We're going to play another short little segment of my interview with Ben Shute, and then we'll come back maybe and hear a song that you wrote and haven't released just yet. So here's Ben and I believe his baby. What has been the most surprising thing that you've learned?
I think one thing that that I definitely didn't appreciate even when I was working on other farms until I was farming on my own was how important the just natural state of soil is to the success of a farm. if you start with good soil, you know, we do tons of work since we use organic practices to be building the soil, building the fertility in our soil, treating it right, not tilling when it's too wet, not compacting it.
What is tilling when it's too wet do? What does compacting it do?
It can, it just, you know, makes makes it a less hospitable environment for the plants. When it's compacted, the roots can't breathe.
Mm-hmm.
If you're tilling when it's too wet, it damages the structure of the soil. That is what enables roots to spread out and access nutrients and things. So we do tons of work to both improve and maintain our soil, but I was shocked at the beginning to learn how much depends on just the geological type of soil that you're on.
Really? It was like people's like, oh, let's start a garden, and then you plow up the lawn, uh-huh. and yeah. uh-huh. you put some seeds in, and you're like, there's nothing's coming up.
Yeah.
Or this is like the weirdest looking pepper I've ever seen.
The first property we farmed on West Curly Corners Road, the Bulkley Farm, we approached there were retired dairy farmers, Pete and Alice Bulkley, about farming on the land, and we were very fortunate that we were working with them, who were lifelong farmers, because they were able to tell us, okay, this is where you should plant your vegetable field.
Really?
And sure enough, of course, you know, they put us on the best acre on the property, on the 115 acres, they put us on the best one because they knew that was going to be good. Because if you went, the White Clay Creek runs through that farm.
Mm-hmm.
If you went to the other side, the north side of the creek, the soil changes so dramatically, it's like being on a different planet.
Really?
It's literally, it's the White Clay Creek because it's a clay soil on the other side of that creek. And I mean, you could like reach your hand down and pull up some soil and make a pot out of it, you know? It's
uh-huh.
like dramatic. And clay soils are very challenging to work with as a farmer because they stay very wet, they don't drain particularly well. If you have one that you can really improve and work with and it can drain out well, then it can be a good thing to have in
some
the mix
clay.
Of your soils because it holds nutrients well.
Mm.
But if you have a poorly drained clay soil, you can do all the right things in terms of soil management and you're still going to be totally having an uphill battle in terms of making a good farm. Whereas after we farmed the Bulkley land for a few years, and we're looking for some more land to expand our veggies onto. At that point, we had learned a thing or two about the value of, you know, starting out with ideal soil. The spot we started on was it was well drained. It was just a good mix of physical soil characteristics. Had, you know, a good mix of silt, sand, and clay, which are the three components of a soil.
The three S's.
Yeah, less, there's a C in there.
Yeah. I just seen if you're paying attention.
and it had been pretty well taken care of. It had, you know, the fertility in there was pretty good.
Well, you'd think a dairy farm, they would have plenty,
yep.
plenty of manure
yeah.
going on there
mm-hmm.
as well.
So, and you know, there are other pieces of the puzzle that don't relate specifically to the soil, but like to access to irrigation water. Like there were ponds on that property that we were able to irrigate from,
mm-hmm.
Which is always a huge necessity for a vegetable farm.
Sure.
But you know, it wasn't the number one perfect vegetable soil. There are more stones than you might want in it. There was a kind of a lower wet spot that was unreliable because sometimes it would be too wet to get into. And so when we were looking to expand our veggie operation, we had been farming for 3 years in the area at that point, and we had learned in that time how important it was to have good soil, and we'd also learned that the soil over at Greg Farm, just a mile or two away, was probably some of the absolute best vegetable soil in the whole state.
Really?
It's very well drained. It's well drained, it's flat, it has almost no rocks.
And that's just because of the glaciers and
It's amazing how critical the glacial activity is to what I do today.
Uh-huh.
It's like there's nothing more important in my day-to-day life probably than what happened with the glaciers, you know. Which is funny to think about.
But, well, it's taking the long view.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, yeah. So you're taking the long view.
Interesting.
Yeah. We are embedded in history, and history is embedded in us, and we can, you know, try and change things, but we are completely dependent on things that happened
Glaciers.
Tens of thousands of years ago. Yeah, and well, and even, you know, millions of years ago, if you think about the fuel we put in our cars, you know. Yep.
Yeah, just, indeed.
Yeah. So that was a little segment on soil. I never knew that Red Hook.
Hardscrabble.
Hardscrabble, in fact, is on some of the finest vegetable land in the state.
Yeah. Who'd have thunk? With a name like Hardscrabble.
I know. I think they were just trying to throw people off.
Yeah.
So you have another tune for us, Liv?
Yeah, I got a couple other tunes if you want.
I want.
Maybe. I have a foraged song.
It's okay.
An Alan Lomax recording.
Oh, lovely.
Of a song called Turnip Greens.
Turnip Greens. Let's hear Turnip Greens. Where's this from?
The title of this song is Turnip Greens. Well, I had a dream the other night. I dreamed that I could fly. Flapped my wing like an eagle and I flew up to the sky. At the gate I met Mr. Gabriel and he looked at me so keen. He asked me what I'd have to eat and I told him turnip greens. Mr. Gabriel also asked me from what country did I fly. And I told him from the Ozarks that I flew up to the sky. He wondered why the men down there were rough and yet so clean. And I said, my Mr. Gabriel, it's them good old turnip greens. Turnip greens, turnip greens, good old turnip greens. Cornbread and buttermilk and good old turnip greens. Mr. Gabriel brought some angel food on a great big silvery bowl. He said, if you will eat this, it will rest your weary soul. Well, it didn't taste like taters and it didn't taste like beans. And it didn't have the flavor of them good old turnip greens. Mr. Gabriel said, young man, I see that you're not satisfied. You'd rather be down yonder on some Ozark mountainside. So I'll tell to you the story of the country of your birth. The Lord's getting ready for his kingdom on the earth. Tomorrow we'll be moving to that great land of the free. That band you hear playing is the Ozark Jubilee.
Wow. Turnip Greens.
It's a pretty cool tune, huh?
And not a bad tune at all. Not, and Alan, that's an old recording by Alan Lomax.
Yeah, it's an Alan Lomax recording of a guy named Neil Morris.
Uh-huh.
And it's from the record Worried Now, Won't Be Worried Long, which is a compilation album that I came upon.
Awesome. Awesome.
Yeah.
So I'm going to throw it back to me, I suppose, and we'll have another short segment. On clover, soil management, and the relationship between teaching and farming. Isn't we have summers off, as you know, and one of the reasons we have summers off traditionally is because, well,
people
kids needed to be out working in the fields. You know, they needed to be helping on the farm. So here's another small short segment with Ben Shute from Hardy Roots Farm.
So now we're being joined by Piper.
Age 5 months.
5 months. Piper, you want to chew on this for a second? That was Piper breathing into the microphone, and now she's sticking out her tongue, and she's got some just solid marble blue eyes. She's just the happiest little chubby baby.
So yeah, Piper was born in January.
Oh.
Perfect time to have a baby on a farm.
Is that right? Do you find like much of your sort of activity regulated by the seasons, obviously?
Yeah, I mean, June is the busiest time on a farm.
So you're not like, it's Saturday, I'm not working today.
Right. Right now I'm taking a break to babysit, but I've got mowing to do and... tractors to move around and stuff like that.
Other than like an hour, you know, a few day, you know, a few hours here, a few hours there, you're every day is you. There's some sort of work to maintain.
Yeah, these days for sure. And then, but it totally is seasonal. I mean, in the winter, I mean, people always say, "What do you do in the winter?" And it's definitely still a full time job. With in terms of like planning and getting prepared and fixing all the things that broke and didn't have time to be fixed in the summer.
That's funny because people, I'm a teacher, and people go, "What do you do in the summer?" Right? And but nobody says, "Oh, those lazy farmers, they have like the whole winter off, and you know, and they should be doing something."
That's not fair.
No, it isn't. It isn't. Maybe it should be some hybrid job.
Yeah, it is a good job to split, I think. But yeah, so but yeah, you know, I think the biggest difference between winter and summer on a farm is in the summer the farm tells you what to do. You have no choice. You're doing whatever is the emergency at the moment.
Right.
And in the winter, you can kind of set your schedule and your priority list because there's less urgency every day. Yeah, there's different. I think there's certainly a lot of different soil types in almost every area. I think, you know, in the Hudson Valley, you can find dramatically different soil types close together. So like here in Claremont, right now we're on kind of a little bit of a plateau of some pretty, it's like extremely well, if not excessively drained soil, very sandy, a little gravelly. So that's a soil that is reliably good for vegetables because in the spring when it might be wet, you can still get on the soil without damaging it. It'll dry out quickly. Well, you know, one of the enemies of vegetables is waterlogged soils that don't allow roots to breathe and take up nutrients. So well-drained is pretty crucial. But usually when you have very well-drained sandy soils, you also are not having quite as much in terms of the fertility of the soil. Because there's, like I said, like clay, which tends to be associated with not well-drained soil, is chemically very good at holding on to nutrients.
So how do you remedy that on this sort of sandy soil?
So the idea, so with us, what we most of the pretty much all the ground we farm is very sandy. So that's if we had to choose one or the other, sandy or and well-drained, or like more clay or silty and not well drained, we would always choose sandy if it had to be a choice of one or the other.
It's easier to improve that.
It's just you can always irrigate and add some nutrients with compost and fertilizer and stuff, but you can never unirrigate. You can't dry out a field if it's waterlogged. I mean, you can put in drainage tiles and stuff in the long term, but if, you know, in the hurricane, if your field floods, you can't undo it. But if you have a well-drained field, you're going to be okay.
You think about rice?
Yeah, rice is an exception.
Would rice grow up here?
There isn't people in Vermont doing trials on growing rice in the Northeast. Oh. I don't know what success they're having.
it doesn't seem like an appealing thing to do.
But I think the ideal for a farm like ours, a diversified farm, is ideally you have a balance of different soils on your farm. You have some very reliably well-drained soils that you can grow on early. And you have some, like, maybe more soils that are in, like, a 100-year floodplain that are, you know, might have a small percentage chance of flooding any given year. So maybe in 1 year out of many, you might get wiped out, like last year in the hurricane.
Yeah.
But that flood event actually brings a lot of fertility onto the soil, a lot of minerals from the creek and stuff. So ideally, you have a balance of different types of soils. So, like, in the summer, in the middle of the summer, when flooding is much less likely, you can grow your summer crops, your corn, which is really demanding of fertility, and some of your fall brassicas and stuff.
Do you grow corn?
We grow some sweet corn, yeah. It's not like our main thing, but and it's not a very space-efficient crop.
Oh, no.
It takes a lot of space to grow sweet corn. And there are a lot of bugs that like to bother it. And since we don't use any synthetic chemicals, it's tricky to manage them. So we grow some because our CSA members love it, but we don't grow a lot. And we don't grow as much as people would love it every week, but that would be too that would just be, it would cost us too much to do that.
Mm-hmm. It is, yeah. From what I've read, it's very depleting of the soil.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, we want to maintain a balance of different types of crops, and since corn takes up so much space per yield, if we grew too much corn, we wouldn't be able to balance it out with our other.
I think I don't know if it's an apocryphal or anecdotal or if it's just BS, but the sort of the Native Americans in the area would grow the three sisters together, mm-hmm. and sort of the corn, squash, and beans.
Mm-hmm.
To does that model work well at all, or is that? I mean,
yeah. Well,
it seemed like, oh, this is brilliant. And, you know, this uh-huh. this fixes the nitrogen in
right,
the soil,
yeah.
and
the beans, yeah.
and this the squash sort of takes care of the weeds with mm-hmm. the, you know, they just run down the rows of corn. That seems perfect. Why doesn't everybody do that?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say we use that philosophy on a different time frame. So, you know, we might grow corn one year, squash the next year, beans the next year.
Oh, okay. You rotate.
As opposed to cramming it all in there at once, which would be more of a management challenge. That, you know, that's the kind of thing that works well on a garden scale or a homestead scale, but that is hard to pull off on a farm scale.
All right. So, difference between gardening and farming.
A lot of things.
Yeah, quite a few things. So, we're kind of running out of time. It sure flew, didn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, bit of a panic, and then...
Where did it go?
I don't know. I think a lot of it just... goes.
Maybe we'll have to go in search of lost time, foraging ahead.
Maybe so. Hopefully be able to join me... next month, Liv.
If
you're not touring
fun.
On the road,
I'm not going anywhere.
I need a sidekick desperately, or somebody I can be a sidekick to.
Next time we should talk about going to look for mushrooms, because that has been quite the adventure lately. As in, there aren't a lot.
There are very, very few mushrooms out. I've seen some oysters, but not a lot. This last rain should be very, very good for the foraging. So we'll
cool.
be out there with the field recorder, and maybe we'll be getting some chow. So you got a couple more tunes for us to play us out.
Yeah.
And then we're going to turn it over to Jackie.
Cool.
And his fantastic show, and always interesting music. So what do we got coming up now on your magic box?
This is an old American and British classic ballad called Dog and Gun, as performed by Grandpa Jones. It's about a farmer and a beautiful girl who falls in love with him.
Is there a dog and a gun?
There sure is.
Oh.
And lots of weird hijinks and adventure.
Okay, let's hear Dog and Gun.
There was a young squire who lived all the way. He courted a rich maiden so fair and so gay. To marry this maiden, it was his intent. Friends and the relatives all gave their consent. The time was appointed, the wedding to see. The squire chose the farmer his waiter to be. No sooner had the lady the waiter espied, he inflamed her heart, oh my true heart, she cried. Instead of getting married, she went to her bed. Thoughts of the farmer still ran through her head. Thoughts of the farmer still ran through her mind, and how he was gaining she was quickly to find. A coat, vest, and pants did the lady put on, and away she went hunting with dog and with gun. She hunted all around where the farmer did dwell, because in her true heart she loved him so well. Often she fired, but nothing she killed. At length the young farmer came into the field to talk to him there. It became her intent, with dog and with gun, on to meet him she went. I thought you'd have been to the wedding, she cried, to give to the squire his beautiful bride. Oh no, said the farmer, the truth to you I'll tell. I couldn't give her to him, I love her so well. It pleased the young lady to see him so bold. She gave him her glove that was flowered with gold, saying, take this, I found it as I came along. I found found it while hunting with dog and with gun. The lady went home with a heart full of love and gave out the news that she'd lost her glove. And the one that will find it and bring it to me, the one that will find it, his bride I will be. It pleased the young farmer to hear of the news. Straightway with the glove to the lady he goes, saying, "Here, honored lady, I've just found your glove. Will you be so kind as to grant me your love?" "My love, it is granted," the lady replied. "I love the sweet breath of the farmer," she cried. "I'll be mistress of dairy and milking of cow, while my jolly young farmer goes whistling to plow." And when they were married, they told of the fun, how she courted the farmer with the dog and with gun. "And now that I have him so close in my snare, I love him forever and vow I don't care."
Hi, I'm Ashley Lair from Germantown, New York. You're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM, Acra, Hudson, Catskill. Hands-on and listener-supported radio.
For those who have forests with marketable timber,